ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Good evening and welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the federal government announces a major shake-up of the Defence Department to deliver projects on time and on budget. Also, the latest on the devastating floods that have killed hundreds of people in several Asian nations. And remote Christmas Island set to become the site of an ambitious project from the tech giant Google.
Hopefully with this sort of, you know, a large facility being built here, if it does, it would provide local jobs, provide stability for internet infrastructure, which would be great, and hopefully it lowers prices.
First this evening, the federal government has announced a major revamp of the Defence Department today. The overhaul comes after accusations from expert observers and the opposition that major defence projects are taking too long to deliver and costs are blowing out. A key change is the merging of three acquisition groups into one independent agency to deliver projects on time and within budget. The move comes as Australia's defence spending is set to nearly double in the next decade to $100 billion. Angus Randall reports.
When you're talking about saving money on weapons and explosives, the appropriate expression is pretty obvious.
The establishment of the Defence Delivery Agency will see a much bigger bang for buck for the defence spend.
Defence Minister Richard Marles announces an overhaul in the way the Defence Department manages major projects. Under the plan, three groups currently tasked with defence acquisitions, the Capability Acquisition and Sustainment Group, the Guided Weapons and Explosive Ordnance Enterprise, and the Naval Shipbuilding and Sustainment Group will become one, the Independent Defence Delivery Agency. Based on current funding, it would put nearly 40% of defence spending into the hands of one agency.
This is one of the most significant reforms to defence that we have seen. It will greatly change the way that defence operates.
The Defence Delivery Agency will launch in July next year, still under the umbrella of the Defence Department. A year later, it will become a fully independent agency, reporting directly to the Ministers for Defence and Defence Industry.
It will mean that advice comes to government much more early in the process about the challenges that are facing any particular program, any particular project, so that we can ensure those projects are delivered on time and on budget.
The defence budget is nearly $60 billion a year. That's set to reach about $100 billion by 2034. Defence Industry Minister Pat Conroy says alongside the increase in overall spending, defence is also having to deal with more complex acquisitions.
15 years ago, 27% of defence projects were complex. That is now doubled to almost 60% of projects being complex.
He hopes this new agency will prevent cost blowouts in the future.
Changes kill projects. Changes kill project schedule and project costs, and we're determined to avoid that by having greater discipline and accountability.
The changes won't affect the delivery of the AUKUS nuclear-powered submarine program. That's run by the Australian Submarine Agency, which sits outside defence and is currently on the hunt for a leader after the agency's head announced he'll retire next year. Defence Minister Richard Marles says there are no immediate job cuts as the three groups emerged into one. However, he left the door open to more efficiencies in the future.
We are not seeing job cuts here. It is the same group of people who are working in these three organisations, or these three groups that will form part of the Defence Delivery Group from the 1st of July next year. But as we move forward, what this group and as it becomes the agency will be about is putting a focus on delivery.
Shadow Defence Minister Angus Taylor wants to see more funding for defence instead of new agencies.
There is nothing in this announcement other than moving bureaucrats around. Now, that may or may not be a good idea. We'll look closely at it. But we need far more than that if we're going to deal with what are the most dangerous circumstances we've faced since the Second World War.
The government will appoint a National Armaments Director to lead the Defence Delivery Agency at a later date.
Angus Randall reporting. Jennifer Parker served with the Royal Australian Navy for more than 20 years. She's now an expert associate at the Security College at the Australian National University and thinks the creation of the new Defence Delivery Agency is a good move.
Now, it is a significant structural change. The Department of Defence, is it the most historic in the last 50 years or some of those terms? No, I don't think that's true. But it is important in terms of improving our acquisition and sustainment process for the capabilities that we bring into defence. So I think it is a good decision. In fact, it actually builds on 20 years of review. So there was a significant review in 2003 of defence's acquisition called the Kinnard Review, and another one in 2008 called the Mortimer Review. Each of these reviews actually recommended that an autonomous delivery agency was developed outside of defence that reported to the minister. Now, governments around 2003 and 2008 didn't support that and it didn't happen, but this is something that a lot of analysis has said we should be doing for a couple of decades.
So what difference do you think it'll make?
So effectively, this group is aimed at streamlining acquisition and sustainment. It'll be a group initially when it's formed on the 1st of, I think it was July 2026, and then it will become an autonomous agency 12 months later, which means similar to the Australian Submarine Agency that we've seen established, it means that it will report directly to the minister. Now, what does this mean? One, it means that it can focus on becoming a delivery agency which supports defence as a customer, which means it can operate much more like a commercial entity with flexibility in terms of contract management, flexibility in terms of budget management, and with the right skill sets of qualified project directors and cost assessors within it. It also means that direct reporting to government means that government is going to be more quickly informed if there is an issue with the management of a project.
Do you agree that there have been cost blowouts in the past? And if so, do you think this new agency will make spending more efficient?
Look, there are certainly examples of defence capability acquisitions being cost blowouts. And there's a number of examples, whether you talk about the Hunter-class frigate program, whether you talk about the offshore patrol vessel program. There are a number of reasons why this happened. One is actually it's really hard to assess the costs of defence capability because of the technical complexity, because of the long-term elements of it. Two, there is a bias to always want to tell government that it's going to be cheaper than it will be because you want government to agree to it. So there's a whole bunch of cultural and technical aspects that mean that we have these cost blowouts. Will this structural change address it? It won't address it in the whole entirety. It certainly will make it more effective to manage acquisition and sustainment. But to address cost blowouts in general, you also need to look at the cultural aspects. So what is the culture you're generating within that group or agency? What are the skill sets? So in fact, the subsequent reviews for the last 20 years looking at capability acquisition and sustainment have always said you need to have people with the professional backgrounds that have industry experience in this organisation. So we still need to address culture, qualifications and processes to really make us more effective.
The Defence Minister, Richard Marles, has also announced today that a Chinese Navy flotilla is being monitored in the Philippine Sea. What's happening there?
This is interesting because the Chinese Navy, it generally operates within what's called the first island chain. So that's kind of, if you drew a line from Japan down to Taiwan to the Philippines. So when a task group from the Chinese Navy goes outside of that first island chain, it raises eyebrows of what are they doing? Because they're operating differently. I think it's, of course, important that Defence is monitoring this capability. And I think it's also important that the Defence Minister acknowledge this today, because we do need to be having more of a conversation with the public about what is changing in our region. And one of the things that's changing is the types of naval deployments that China is doing, as we experienced earlier this year.
Jennifer Parker from the Security College at the Australian National University. In Asia, more than 900 people are now feared to have died in the flash flooding and landslides caused by intense storms. The disaster has hit Indonesia, Thailand, Malaysia, the Philippines and Sri Lanka, and hundreds more people are missing. Kathleen O'Connor has more.
Monsoonal rain has caused destruction across at least six countries in Asia. Sri Lanka is one of the worst areas hit. The storm there was caused by tropical cyclone Ditwa, bringing flash flooding and landslides, killing more than 300 people so far. 15,000 homes have been destroyed, hospitals are underwater. Search and rescue teams are still working desperately to save people stranded on their rooftops. 200,000 people are sheltering in safety centres. Authorities have declared it a national emergency. Sri Lankan President Anura Kumara Dissanayake addressed the nation.
As a country, we are facing the largest and most challenging natural disaster in our history. Looking ahead, we must face the immense task of reconstruction and recovery. The estimated scale of destruction is severe.
In Australia, people are watching anxiously. Cecil Fonseca is the head of the Sri Lankan community organisation here, called Panaruda. He's been fielding calls from many Sri Lankans in Australia unable to contact their loved ones.
Almost everyone is affected. I mean, their relatives are homeless or their friends are dead and other people are in shelter. One third of the country has no electricity since Friday.
Cecil Fonseca says the scale of the devastation is difficult to comprehend.
My wife's relatives are in serious trouble. Apparently, their furniture all went floating out of the house. There's only two locations in the entire village that the people can go and stay, and they are all gathered there.
It's prompted calls for international help. Australia's Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has promised $1 million to help Sri Lanka deliver essential services to communities in need. Meanwhile, in Indonesia, the province of northern Sumatra is also in crisis. The streets resemble a war zone thanks to another tropical cyclone called Senja. More than 400 people have died in Indonesia and hundreds more are still unaccounted for. Motorcyclists drive through floodwater on the main road, dodging the ripped-up bitumen and abandoned cars. Doors and roofs from businesses torn off in the weather lay off to the side as residents clean up and assess the damage. Residents are running out of essential supplies. Francisco Fernando from World Vision Indonesia is helping to provide aid in the area.
The government have already deployed a lot of logistics using the helicopters, for example, to the isolated areas. So food, medicines and some of the basic needs are being deployed, not only by the national governments, but also from the local CSOs, including us.
Parts of Thailand, Malaysia and Vietnam were also inundated. Hakim bin Hamza from the medical relief not-for-profit organisation Mercy is in Malaysia.
It's been on and off. Initially, it hit the east coast, the state of Kelantan. The number of evacuees went up to about more than 15,000 in Kelantan alone. But as a whole in Malaysia, it went as high as 35,000. So this year, it has been the worst in the last 15 years. And they were caught by surprise. Many places were inundated with water. The state capital, Kanga, was about 90% underwater.
Authorities in southern India are now on high alert. Flights have been cancelled and students sent home from school as Cyclone Ditwa approaches.
Kathleen O'Connor reporting. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Around Australia, many farming communities are objecting to the construction of new electricity transmission lines as part of renewable energy projects. In Western Victoria, some farmers are refusing to give state government workers access to their properties, and that's holding up a project designed to export renewable energy to New South Wales. This report from Alicia Thomas-Sam.
$11.4 billion project.
Tension between farmers and the Victorian government over a multi-billion dollar energy project has boiled over.
We consistently told you that you're not coming on.
Last week, around 50 farmers gathered at a property in Manu, 280 kilometres west of Melbourne, to conduct what they call a gate protest.
You should just get in your car and leave, mate. You're wasting your time.
They were there to block a representative of VicGrid from entering the property. VicGrid is the Victorian government body building the transmission towers.
I'd ask you if you all kindly move to the side and allow us access to the property to conduct that survey.
Access denied.
Farmer Trent Carter refuses to let VicGrid onto his property.
It's a dead set no, that there is no one coming onto our farm. Full stop.
VicGrid is trying to conduct ecological surveys for a project known as the VNI West, which is a proposed 240-kilometre transmission line from Western Victoria heading north to New South Wales. It'll be used to export electricity from planned renewable energy zones.
We're going to become a monument of stupidity, yeah, just with steel structures everywhere.
Trent Carter fears the power lines will interfere with his machinery and production on his farm.
It's certainly 100% for sure going to be at a detriment to our production and the way we do things. Technology, machinery, livestock, biosecurity measures. It's just untapped area that we just don't know.
The ABC requested an interview with Victoria's Energy and Resources Minister Lily D'Ambrosio, who directed us to VicGrid. Its chief executive is Alistair Parker, who says the project is essential to facilitate Victoria's transition to renewables.
I can understand people feeling that strongly, but the vast majority of people actually support these projects. They want reliable power, they want renewable power to be connected up. It's really important from our perspective that we do maintain reliable electricity supplies in Victoria.
In August, the Victorian government granted VicGrid staff new powers to force landowners to give them access to conduct surveys for the VNI West. They haven't forced entry yet, but if farmers continue to refuse, they could face consequences.
But if somebody continues to deny access, the next step, regrettably, would be to send an authorised officer out with the survey party, and the authorised officer has the power to request the access again, and if it's denied in those circumstances can issue a fine, I think of $800, and potentially a court can issue a larger fine of $6,100. This is not what we want to do.
Trent Carter says he's unfazed by the threat of fines and will continue to block VicGrid from stepping on his land.
I'm happy to cop fine after fine after fine. Here for the long haul and for the next generation.
That's farmer Trent Carter at Manu in Western Victoria. And you can see more on that story from Alicia Thomas-Sam on 7:30 on ABC TV and iView tonight. In an Australian first, GPs in Queensland are now able to diagnose and treat ADHD in adults. In the past, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder could only be diagnosed by a clinical psychologist or psychiatrist and an initial prescription only written by a psychiatrist. Other states and territories are now planning to follow Queensland's lead to cut waiting times and costs for patients. Claudia Williams filed this report.
Casey-Ann Mabbott is tidying up her mud kitchen. It's an outdoor play facility which she runs with her sister Angie in Logan, south of Brisbane.
I don't think I would be who I am, and I don't think I'd be doing what I'm doing if it wasn't for the way that I do things and my brain.
Miss Mabbott got a referral for a specialist ADHD assessment 2 years ago, but she's still waiting for an appointment.
I think it'll help me because it'll help me get the support I need at the time when I need it. I don't feel like I always need support, but sometimes things happen in my life where I do feel like I need different supports at different times.
But it's hoped a big reduction in wait times could be coming, as GPs in Queensland will be able to start diagnosing and treating ADHD in adults from today. Other states and territories are moving in a similar direction. South Australia will provide additional training for GPs to both diagnose and treat the condition. Tasmania has committed to introducing changes, and the ACT has called for expressions of interest for a pilot program. and 65 GPs in Western Australia are in training to diagnose and prescribe patients aged 10 and above. But not everyone in Queensland is excited about the decision.
Very disappointed to hear that in Queensland, the changes are not going to be supported by any training.
Dr. David Coghill is a psychiatrist and the president of the Australasian ADHD Professionals Association.
Everybody who manages a new health condition needs to be able to be trained in assessing, diagnosing and managing and supporting people with that condition. For ADHD, the particular issues are all the way through that care journey. The task for people assessing ADHD is both to make sure that we recognise when someone does have ADHD, but also that we can recognise when someone's presenting with something they might think is ADHD, but actually is better explained by other difficulties.
In Queensland, GPs have been able to diagnose and prescribe medication for children aged between 4 and 17 for years. The change will extend that policy to include adults. Dr. Aaron Chambers is a GP based in Brisbane.
This is going to really unblock red tape for patients, and it's fantastic news actually for patients because it means that it'll be much easier for a patient who's got an established diagnosis of ADHD to be able to be prescribed their ADHD medication by their regular GP who knows them best and they trust, and it massively reduces a lot of red tape and administrative roadblocks.
Brisbane GP Aaron Chambers, Claudia Williams with that report. Well, it's probably the last place you'd expect to see one of the world's biggest tech companies launching an ambitious project. But Google has big plans for the Australian territory of Christmas Island off Western Australia. It's aiming to build a data hub on the island to connect Australia to underwater communications cable systems on several other continents. The announcement has received a mixed reaction from locals, as Mieta Adams reports.
Christmas Island is about as isolated as an Australian territory can be. It's 1,500 kilometres off the northern coast of WA. The island is powered by imported diesel, and its digital infrastructure is well behind the mainland. And before its first fibre cables were laid 6 years ago, residents relied on satellites. One of the two internet technicians on the island, Alex Jensen, describes what it was like.
If you're at home and it started raining, for instance, you would lose connectivity. So in the heavy times with heavy rain, you'd be sitting at home without the ability to do anything aside from maybe read a book or, you know, something inside.
Now, Google is planning to build what's dubbed a connectivity hub on Christmas Island. A fortnight ago, the tech giant announced plans to lay two new underwater cable projects that would connect at Christmas Island, linking Australia to some of the world's largest cable systems, stretching between the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. Melbourne-based telecommunications company Vocus will lay the first of Google's subsea cables. Michael Ackland, National General Manager of Government Projects at Vocus, expects construction would begin mid-2026.
It's good business for Australia. These are digital superhighways, and they are critical to the digital economy. So the more cables that you can find along your way or using or going through you, the more chance that you've got to join that digital economy.
The plan comes after Google signed a 3-year cloud storage agreement with Australia's Defence Department in July. Samuel Bashfield, a defence researcher at La Trobe University, says as China's ambitions grow in the region, Australia's north has an increasing strategic importance.
Just like society needs these robust and these secure data communication pipelines, the military also does. So I think that a lot of these projects will really enable Australia's military to much more secure, much faster, much more resilient data connectivity that it requires. Its strategic location has been used to further national interests in the past. So, I mean, thinking of the Immigration Detention Centre, for example. So I think that, you know, there's a real uncertainty over some of these projects and what the benefits for locals will be.
Locals like Alex Jensen are hopeful the plan will come through, especially given Christmas Island's main economic driver, phosphate mining, is beginning to wrap up.
Hopefully with this sort of, you know, a large facility being built here, if it does, it would provide local jobs, provide stability for internet infrastructure, which would be great, and hopefully it lowers prices, because one of the biggest things about living here is that your prices across the board, whether it be food, flights, accommodation, internet, are quite expensive.
Google says its connectivity hub would be smaller and require less power than a typical data centre. The CEO of the island's phosphate miner, Nicholas Gann, wants Google to push the development of energy infrastructure on the island.
If they're able to come in and put some renewable energy in, which then helps them but also helps the community, we would fully welcome that and we would absolutely work with them on that.
Nicholas Gann is the CEO of the phosphate miner PRL on Christmas Island. That report from Mietta Adams. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, I'm Sydney Peed, filling in for Sam Hawley for the ABC News Daily podcast. Every day, millions of us take vitamin supplements hoping for a health boost, but there's been a sharp rise in people suffering numbness and nerve damage after unknowingly overdosing on vitamin B6. Today, reporter for the ABC's 7:30 program, Tom Hartley, on his year-long investigation into the surge in cases and the regulators' long overdue crackdown. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.